Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to what I promise will be another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. So glad you joined us tonight. Whether it was on accident or on purpose, either way, we'll take it. We're just glad you're on board listening. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio, across the way, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
Bill, how you doing?
I'm good. We got Alex on the board.
Hi, Alex.
Whatever.
Oh, got to turn my mic on. Hey.
Yeah, and then we have in-studio guest Annie is going to come on in just about 10 minutes, George.
And Alex wonders why we don't go to him more often, right?
That's true. Yeah.
Getting the show started, making sure you're on the air.
Isn't that nice? Well, God has a yes for you, not just a no. And give the desire to him, and he can transform your life. And our guest is going to share that experience. If you're a Christian, you're not a citizen of the world trying to get to heaven. You're a citizen of heaven making your way through the world. And our guest tonight is going to talk about her navigation through this world, recovering from a drinking problem and what God has done in her life. It's going to be great.
It's going to be exciting, Bill. I never get tired of hearing of what God has done in people's lives. Very transforming. The only source that can truly change us. It's your turn now.
Okay. George, I say that you don't really have problems. You have patterns that create problems. That's my profound thought for the night.
Well, I think the problems are what create the patterns. So we're both on the same page.
Okay.
That there's an inner cause to it. We're not going to change by outside behaviors. It's a lot easier to act our way into right thinking than to think our way into right acting. But the core problem is I'm not enough, and I need God. And anytime I try to get these God substitutes, which can be patterns, drinking, trying to make money, everything to make myself okay and fulfill me, I'm going to come up short.
George, it doesn't help that our lives from birth are wired for self-destruction as a result of sin.
Yes.
That doesn't help. So if we don't have the God's Holy Spirit and the restraining power of the Holy Spirit in our lives, we are going to become monsters.
Well, my best efforts, I don't have enough ability to overcome my problems. And that's why we need to go to God. And tonight we're going to talk about step three. We talk about a step every week. And we're not about the program. We're using the steps to get closer to God and to walk out our faith with Jesus. And tonight at step three, we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand him. And we understand him to be Jesus Christ. It's not a higher power. It's the highest power. But what I want to do is focus on that care of God. Bill, if I'm going to ask Jesus to be my savior of my life, he's got to be Lord over all areas of my life. And I don't want to hold on to my sex life, my work life, and just give him my drinking life. I need to bow my knee to his authority in all areas.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a problem for a lot of people, George.
It's a problem for all of us, we have a prayer we can say. There's a third-step prayer, and a lot of the program is not about stopping a behavior. It's about developing a relationship with the living God, and that is Christ. And the prayer is, God, you know, take me.
Mm-hmm.
And help me to overcome my selfishness, and let me know what you want me to do, because my drinking isn't about making my life better. It's about giving my life in service to you. That's a tall order.
George, I agree, but as I look at step three, made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I know historically, because I've learned this from you, that there is rooted in the original Oxford group who started AA, that as God, as you understood him, meant where are you in your understanding of Jesus? Where are you in your walk with Jesus?
How far along are you in your relationship? And unfortunately, over the years, that has got watered down in 12-step groups, that the God can be the group.
Mm-hmm.
Just a bunch of people who have the same problem you do, and by listening to them, you're going to get a lot better. The way we get better in listening to other people is by what God has done in their life and what part of their life they have yielded to God, so his power can come through in truth and transform them. That's why you get that from the group. But our best thinking got us in here,
mm-hmm.
and we want to get back to Jesus. Everything goes through him and comes from him. He created everything, and he said in John 15:5, apart from me, you can do nothing. Want to focus on that.
You're doing great tonight, George. On a scale of 1 to 2, I'd put you at a solid 1.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So there's been some improvement.
There's definitely improvement. Now, I want to talk about a verse from Luke that you you like to cite regularly, George, and I really appreciate this verse, and that is 9:23. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Now, I think that doesn't that refer to you need to die to yourself?
Right.
Say some more about that.
Well, that's what we do in steps 1, 2, and 3. I can't do it. He can't do it. I'm going to let him do it. Where we see a lot of people make a mistake, it's not about working a program. It's about using the steps to put yourself to death so Christ can come in. And what we do is we have to do this daily. I hear a lot of people say, you know, I made the magic prayer. I made a decision for Christ, and I'm good now. No, Jesus said you got to deny yourself and pick up your cross daily. Paul said he prayed to have that removed from him, and it wasn't because Jesus said to him, my grace is sufficient for you.
Mm-hmm.
One of the greatest blessings about being an addict is I have to stay in constant contact and submission to Jesus, or I will mess up my life big time. Okay? And that's a luxury, really. But we've got to remember that we don't have this. Every day I wake up, I got to make a decision. So do you. So does everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, George, as we look at step 3 and made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God, I pray for all the people listening tonight that if you are in a place of desperation or you're kicking the can and you need to figure out what to do with your life and you are out of control, decision number one is taking your will, and because we all have this autonomy, we've got this sense of independence. We don't want anyone telling us what to do.
Yep.
A fool delights in airing his own opinions. A fool always thinks he's right, and a fool hates correction. That's three proverbs that I cling to all the time. Proverbs 19:3 says, a fool will blow up his own life and then be angry at God. So we have to figure out, we have to dial in that to make a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God is a big, big step because it's a very proactive one.
Well, we hear a lot in the recovery rooms about being an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And really what that is we're trying to be God and we know we don't have the game to do it. So what this step is telling us to do is get out of the way of being the center of the universe and hand that back to God. Quit trying to be God. Don't make all the decisions in your life. Submit. Obey. Try to be holy.
Mm-hmm.
And pray.
George, is it I'm loved because I'm good, or is it I'm good because I'm loved?
Well, I don't think we are good.
Well, okay, I'm just trying to get a little playful here. Thanks for killing that game.
I think that there's a real truth there, though, is I need to, in the first two steps, realize that total depravity in our lives is true. I know it wasn't that funny, but, that's why Calvin never got booked for comedy, you know. But I think there's some truth here that I need to really recognize that I don't have a drinking or a drug problem. I have a living problem.
Mm-hmm.
And if I eliminate the drinking and drugging, I still have the problem because it's me, and I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it, and I want to do a lot of it, and I have to hand that back to God.
Yeah. All right. To maybe make this point a little bit more clear, do you understand you're a sinner saved by grace, or do you think Christianity is just trying to be good?
Sinner saved by grace.
Perfect. All right. Maybe the second test would be, are you actually seeing a real character change in your life? Have you seen your character change throughout your growth and your journey with the Lord?
Oh, I think most of us do. And one of the great, great ways to look on that is to see what other people would say about you that are in your life. Can they rely on you now? Do you show up when you say you're going to? Can they rely on you to be there at work, at play, and at home? Because when we're used, and nobody can rely on us for anything except that phone call to get us out of jail that they know is coming.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the third test might be, you know, the Bible always says that your worst problem is that you don't know God like you should. I think that's one of our big struggles. And then is your Christianity or is your walk with God a matter of nominal belief? And is it a round of rules and regulations, or is there some personal dealing that's going on with you and God? Is there something intimate that's happening between you and God?
Well, it's a relationship, but I can see from the outside thinking it's a bunch of do's and don'ts. One of the things we know when our heart is transformed is we want to do it. And we always tell guys that we're working with in recovery, and we only work with men, is that you have to do this till you want to do it. And when you have Christ and you have a new life, you can't help but share that. But you got to trust it and you got to take it by faith because, let's face it, we want things right away and you have to be patient. There's delayed gratification here.
Mm-hmm. All right, George, we're looking
at... Any more questions?
Yeah, I do have a couple more questions.
Okay.
Because Christmas is next week, and I need to give you my shirt size and P.O. box number.
I'd rather buy a new jacket, you know what I'm saying?
Well, I'm just saying, I want you to...
I mean, I like it. I just, every time I see you, you're wearing it.
And it's do nice. You have a point?
No, I'd like to get you another one, a little variety.
I like that jacket.
It's kind of a Ninja Turtle thing. It's green, it's got some leather on it, and I like it.
You know, I'm trying to be friendly, George.
You're trying to be a Christian.
I'm trying to be a Christian.
You've got to love people you don't like, Bill. Put me at the top of that list.
Get behind me, Fraser, is what I'm saying. Anyway, we've got a wonderful in-studio guest, Annie Kackman. She is a former Marine. So we got some military brass here in the studio tonight, George.
Better behave.
Trust me, we've been behaving to this point. She's going to tell her story and
looking
her journey.
Looking forward to it, yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to take a little break, and then when we come back, we're going to get her on the studio line. Well, she's here in studio. You're in for a treat tonight. Stay tuned. Real Recovery will be right back. There's the chairman, George. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Glad you've joined us tonight, Bill, George, Alex in studio tonight. We're going to start talking to Annie Kackman. She has got quite a story of recovery, and she's young, and she's been a Marine, and things started early for her in her using. And George, that seems to be what always happens.
It's usually 8th or 9th grade, 13, 14, 15, doesn't it?
Yep. So let's get the conversation underway. Annie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, was in fact true? Is that true? About 14, you started?
Sounds about right.
And what was the thing you first reached for? Was it drugs, pot?
Actually, yep. Started smoking weed when I was probably going into about 9th grade.
Okay. And was it just the fun thing to do, or were there social pressures? Was it a lubricant for you to be accepted, or to be more comfortable, or to be one of the cool group, or what was it? What was going on?
I remember smoking weed for the first time with my older brother before school. So he had gotten his driver's license. I had been taking the hour-long bus ride into town every day. I remember he didn't take me with him for the longest time, which was confusing for me because I thought, you know, we're both going to the same place. I could ride with you. So that didn't happen. But one day he brought me with him, and that's when I discovered that he wasn't going straight to school. He was stopping at his best friend's house every morning and smoking a bowl of weed before first period. So. Mm-hmm.
And you joined in on that activity.
I did.
Okay.
Yep.
I suppose you can't smoke on the bus, you know, Bill. So that seems like a real treat the first time. I bet you thought you were cool and you were putting something over on everybody and you're with the older kids and it had to be great, right?
Yeah. I don't actually remember even getting high the first time I smoked, but I might as well have for how it made me feel to have kind of shared that experience with my brother and his friend. And then just, like, seeing him around the building, seeing him around high school is kind of like, you know, I just felt like nobody knew what I was doing, and it felt like this little secret society that I had with him.
That's pretty attractive at first.
Well, is it 9th grade, Annie?
Yep.
Yeah, 9th grade. So you've got an older brother, and, you know, it's part of being cool. Sadly, it is part of being cool.
Yep. So we have a positive to start with on our using, and that's going to reinforce that. So what happened? Did you just do it in the morning, or were you partying on the weekends? Did it escalate for you?
Yeah, it started about 9th grade, I want to say. You know, it's hard to remember details looking back, but I remember I eventually started doing it during lunch, leaving. Eventually, when I got my driver's license, gravitating towards other kids who later on smoked weed. But at the time, nobody in my grade, as far as I knew, were smoking yet or anything like that. So I just kind of hung out with my brother and his friends and did that. I eventually ended up quitting hockey and getting a job, I remember, so that I could buy my own weed.
You were playing hockey in high school?
Yep. I've been ice skating since I was about 5. So that was a huge priority for me, and I also ran track in the off season to kind of stay in shape for that. So once I started smoking, it became the priority.
Mm-hmm.
So I started washing dishes and doing little pickup jobs like that to get a paycheck so I could buy my own weed.
So eyebrows must have been getting raised because, you know, Annie's quit hockey She's working now part-time. What kind of red flags were going up in the family, or were you doing this under the radar?
Yeah, I feel like it was under the radar. I feel like my mom and I had a good relationship up until I was older, for sure. Started getting into, like, junior year. That's when the weekend drinking kind of started happening, sneaking out, lying, that kind of stuff. I remember I would say that I was going to football games or volleyball games when really I had no interest in those things at all. I was going to go hook up with other kids who were doing shady stuff too. So,
were there any church activities growing up? Were you going to church? Did you believe in God?
Yeah, I started going to church when my parents got divorced when I was 5. And I remember when my dad moved, he moved in next door to this really great family who brought him to an Assemblies of God church. And that's where he ended up meeting his wife and everything. But I started going to church with him. I actually was in junior Bible quiz. I remember I was on that part of that team. I believed in it from the very beginning. I never questioned anything about God, or I just didn't feel like it was going to stop me from doing or trying anything. So
that sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it, George?
Well, it's tough to compete when you're that age with, you know, junior Bible quiz or go, you know, get high and drinking with your friends. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. At that point, that's tough. And that's why I think the church activity groups that are fun and have a lot of people in are so important, because you're looking for identity, who you are in school. And we've given up the hockey, which was important, I'm sure, at that time. Mm-hmm. Because I want to get a job so I can keep getting high. And that's kind of a lifestyle. And you see a big, big switch here.
Mm-hmm. So then you're now working your way through high school and you're just using all the time.
Yep.
Okay.
Pretty much.
So we are fully in a cycle pattern of using. And you have dropped one of the loves, hockey. And now you've got a pattern that is probably going to... is going to stick with you throughout all of high school. And did you graduate?
I did graduate. I feel like it's important to touch on the fact that I did move. I made a significant move when I was in going from elementary school to middle school. I went from Egan Middle School, going from 5th to 6th grade. When my mom got remarried to my stepdad, we moved up to a really small town in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wanted to say that because culturally, that's kind of what people were doing up there. I learned that, you know, a lot of, like, people's parents even smoked weed when I was in high school. The reason I kind of left my church behind or what I knew of it was because my dad was still down in the cities. And I went from, you know, seeing him down in the cities to kind of seeing him every other weekend. And then the older I got, I, you know, maybe had activities or just things that I wanted to do that I didn't go see him. So those times that I didn't go see him, I didn't go to church.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And when you'd go see him, you'd go to church?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And he had also gotten remarried to a woman who's a strong believer. So going down there and being a part of that was just so irregular at that point that... it just was easy to leave. It was easy to walk away from, like, something that I just did in the cities and not where I was from.
Two different worlds there, Bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, leading a little bit of a double life.
Yep.
You've got two different options and two different faces you can wear, right?
Totally.
Yeah, so that's interesting. All right, now we're moving to a small town in Wisconsin, and there's probably perhaps less to do socially there.
Yep.
But you had plenty of activity if you were going to be using all the time.
Right.
So you were relatively content, and you found a small number of people to keep partying with, and so things were good.
Right.
Okay. Now, what about trying to plan for a future? Young
yeah.
lady, what are your future plans?
Yeah. So I wasn't making any plans, actually, to get a little bit more in depth with my drug use, if you will. I actually, at that point, I remember my junior year, after I'd gotten my driver's license, I started hanging out with other kids from different towns, you know, because it is such small communities up there that you hang out with other people from neighboring towns. And I started taking prescription pills, snorting pills, stuff like that. And I didn't save any money, and I was not looking at going to college. And or anything like that. And it was right around my junior year that my brothers had graduated and joined the Marine Corps together.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And you started to watch them move on in a military career, and that was looking attractive to you as well?
Not at the time, I don't think. I can even remember saying at one point that I would never do that, and it just wasn't for me. But I do remember when they left, I did feel somewhat abandoned. I mean, just because my parents having gotten split up at a young age, I think I put most of my eggs in my brother's baskets. If that makes sense, they were kind of my end-all, be-all relationships that I felt like they, you know, understood me and knew where we were all coming from the same place and had the same parents. So when they left, I felt a little bit isolated, and I felt like my drinking kind of kept me, like, connected to them. I know that sounds weird, but it's like it was something that I was carrying on. Even after they had left, it made me feel, well, especially to my one brother who was closer to me in age, it just...
George, did she just sneak in the word drinking? I haven't heard the word drinking up till now.
Yes,
have you?
She did earlier.
Weekend drinking.
Oh, weekend drinking. Okay, thank you. You caught that. I didn't.
Yeah, I didn't think it was any big deal. Obviously, you didn't either. We let it slide. Here's what I'm thinking. Why you might have wanted to quit, because if I'm partying, when I was in high school, the last thing I would want to do would be join the Marines.
Right.
Was that going to help you get straight? Was that part of the thinking there, that I need to straighten out?
Yep. Eventually, it did become kind of, not an ultimatum, but on my 18th birthday, I had already gotten in two different car accidents with two different cars. My mom and I's relationship started to dwindle after, I think she probably, like, you know, tried to look through some journals and figure out what was going on with me and why we weren't close anymore. Mm. And stuff like that. And she was always trying to hold me accountable and discipline me and be a mom, and I wasn't ever having any of it. And so on my 18th birthday, it was the beginning of my senior year, because I turned 18 in September, I actually just dropped out of high school and moved out of my mom and my stepdad's house, and I moved back down to the cities. And I re-enrolled in a school down there and kind of stayed with my dad for a little bit until he, you know, obviously caught on to the same type of behaviors and tried to discipline me, ground me, keep me in the house. So I moved out of there. I ended up staying with my grandma, who lived in a senior citizen apartment for 65-year-olds and up. So it didn't really fit in great there. Ended up not getting my diploma on time from the school I was going to. So I obtained my diploma through something called adult-based education, which is exactly what it sounds like. A bunch of older people trying to get their GEDs at 8 o'clock at night. And then that's when I came to around the corner on making the decision to join the military, too. I remember my brother came home on leave once, and he said, you know, it'd probably be good for you, and... You know, you get a paycheck, and he said it's basically like going to your normal 9-to-5 job. You just wear a uniform. I thought that doesn't sound too bad.
I ain't get killed too, but other than that, it's just like weren't there two wars going on then?
Yeah, well, okay. Yep, the war overseas had obviously been going on for 10+ years at that point.
Okay, I'm still stuck on the senior citizen 65 and over, Bill.
Couldn't use the elevator. Had
are you looking
the
for any place to live, George? Or...
Oh, surely.
She can talk to you after the show.
Yeah, give me an address after the show.
Sure.
So your options, you're starting to... Did you feel inside that you had a problem, that you're kind of going the wrong way? Did you know that?
I knew that because I knew that I had developed a severe physical dependency on... Can I say what... prescription.
Sure.
I was snorting Adderall, and it just became something that so quickly became like I knew that I needed it. Otherwise, I felt like I knew that I needed it. And at that point, it was hard to buy alcohol, you know, not being 21. So I think I just turned to buying pills off of people who went to my high school. And then when I did drink, I almost always blacked out. And so, yeah, I knew that I was, you know, had an addictive personality or whatever, however you want to call it. I knew that I liked to party, and I knew I needed structure in my life. And especially if my older brother and I were so cut from the same cloth, him and I especially, more than the other brother, I just thought if he can do it, I can do it.
So soon to be three Marines in the family, huh?
Yep.
All right. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to hear more about this journey with Annie. You're listening to Real Recovery. Thanks for being with us tonight. I hope you're enjoying tonight's show. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Glad you joined us tonight. We're talking to Annie Kackman. She is at the point in her story where she is still using, but thinks, maybe I'll join the Marines, and that will help me clean up my life a little bit. I've got two brothers in the Corps, and maybe it's now time to take my step into the service. So how scary was it going to the recruiting office and saying yes?
It wasn't terribly scary, and hearing you say that, you know, I joined to clean up my life is pretty accurate, but I also really looked up to my brothers, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so they meant so much to me, and, you know, I'm patriotic, and I love my country and everything like that, so I hate to make it sound like I joined just because it was...
Of course. Yeah, I appreciate you saying that.
And no. I think it's great, okay. Yeah,
because it's an incomplete statement to say you joined the Marines to clean up your life, but... That's a component of it.
Well, because, I mean, I was athletic at that point. I felt like I, it was something that I could do.
Absolutely.
You know? Especially when people asked me if it was something that I was going to do. It just kind of planted the idea. And so it was like, yeah, I mean, I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
It's an adult thing to do. I mean, I really respect that at any age to do it. But at that age to do it, I'm going to do something for my country. Something other than for myself.
Right.
And maybe I'll straighten out along the way. Fair?
Yeah, absolutely fair.
You know, I'll have to buckle down a little bit, as my dad would say, if I do that.
Yeah.
And good for you. How did it go?
Thank you.
Down to the recruiting. What's the process like?
Well, I already knew the recruiter just from having met him when I went in with my brothers. And so I just kind of walked in, and I don't think he was super surprised to see me. Maybe we were friends on Facebook when I had one at that point in time, and I just walked in and said, this is something that I'm going to do, and yeah, I knew right there that I was going to go. They didn't have to send me through any kind of...
Okay, so now you get into, is it basic training, and how long of a program is that?
It's 3 months.
3 months, okay, so now you're not using anymore, right?
Right.
Okay, how are you feeling?
It took a while for them to get a clean UA out of me. I remember that. So in order to go down to MEPS, it's called,
mm-hmm.
I would not quit smoking or using Adderall. So I prolonged my own boot camp reservation.
Okay. And a clean UA, George, is?
A clean UA.
Well, I don't know if our listeners know what that means.
Well, they take a urine test to see if you have any drugs in there, and if they screen for tobacco and mm-hmm. amphetamines and opioids and marijuana probably too, and maybe alcohol.
Yep.
And you were not passing those?
No.
So boot camp went from 3 months to how long?
Well, it just prolonged how long it took me to ship out to go to boot camp. But I eventually went to boot camp. It's 3 months long. Then I got out, and then I did something called Marine Combat Training. That's a month long in... North Carolina. So, and then they send you to your MOS school, your military occupational specialty school. So that was in North Carolina as well. That was a few months long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I picture George day one at boot camp, him saying, "You guys, wait up." That's what I picture anyway.
Army training, sir. Yeah. We've seen Stripes. So
sure.
What was this like? I mean, all of a sudden, this is a real deal. I mean, this is a no joke kind of deal, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Marine Corps, I mean,
no
I only
cigarettes?
Know.
No cigarettes? You're not getting high? Wasn't that hard?
Yeah, it was hard, but it's a serious wake-up call. I mean, I knew it. Your recruiters do a good job of informing you of what it's going to be like. And, you know, if you've seen Full Metal Jacket, that's like a good representation of how Marine Corps boot camp really is. You know, not for the women per se, but...
But very intense.
Lots of yelling,
mm-hmm.
for sure. Physical training is difficult, but the hardest part is the mental and emotional toll it kind of takes on you. You have to know that nothing's personal, and, you know, they're just, that's what they do. They're making Marines, so.
Yeah, I tried doing this show with him for 4 years.
Everything's personal with me, Phil.
Everything's personal.
I really admire that, Bill, because you're young, and all of a sudden, you're not going out at night with your buddies and guys are yelling at you and you're, wow, that's a huge transformation from I'm partying. Sorry, I was just going through this in my head. So, but it had to be an adjustment for you as well.
Yep. Yeah. For anyone,
were you glad
I think.
You did it?
Yeah, in the moment, it was really tough to get through boot camp, for sure. But
what time do you get up in the morning?
I'm like 5, I'm pretty sure. You get up at around 5.
Do they bring you a coffee cart into the barracks?
Oh, no. No? Negative.
No cigarettes, no coffee?
Mm.
You can't tell me you want to rack in today that come back in an hour or two. You can't do that.
No, it's funny that you say that, though, because so many people don't actually know what boot camp is like. And I did have a friend who sent me 2 Marlboro Smooths in the mail and a little couple of matches. So that didn't end well for me. I don't know if she thought I could smoke them or what she thought when she sent those to me, but it wasn't good for me.
Okay, so now we're at a point where what happened? Did you end up relapsing?
In the Marine Corps?
Yes.
Well, I never had gotten sober per se, or was trying to achieve any sobriety. I mean, you have to be sober through boot camp. And then when I got to my MOS school in North Carolina, I was drinking underage and stuff like that. But I didn't go back to drugs when I was in the military.
I suppose the partying is pretty intense when you can. I suppose for a lot of people, right, in the military.
Yeah. Yep, out in town, there's a lot of people just go get hotels over the weekend and drink. And anywhere within like a 5, 10, 15-mile radius of a military installation, there's strip clubs and bars and casinos and car dealerships, because they know that those people are getting paychecks every 2 weeks. And so, yeah, it's just a lot of places to sin.
So I'm working hard, and I can play hard.
Yep.
And that worked for a while, didn't it?
It did, yeah. I had a good run when I was in the States, and that's about the time that I found out that I was going to Okinawa, Japan on a 2-year forward deployment. So there's actually no legal drinking age over there. You're supposed to be 20 to drink when you're overseas, but out in town, they don't care if you're 10 years old. I mean, if you have money, they'll sell it to you.
Wow.
Thank you, Bill. That was quite the contribution.
Well, I chimed in, George, is what I did, is I chimed in.
Well, it lets us know you're still here.
I'm very, very alert on this whole deal. So you never really had a true sense of recovery the whole time you were serving?
No, I just felt like I was just to the point where I told you guys that I was getting stationed in Japan. I haven't even touched on the. I went to treatment. I went to actually rehab when I was in the Marine Corps. They flew me to San Diego, California, and I went to a treatment for 28 days there. So when I got back, I was expected to fulfill a commitment to be sober for. I think I signed a contract saying I'd be sober for 365 days, and that's coming from the highest officer in my battalion, your commanding officer. Mm-hmm. So I drank almost immediately upon getting back. I didn't accept the fact that I could even be really an alcoholic. I knew I was abusing alcohol just because of how much I blacked out, but I thought that I could train myself to get better at that point. And like I said, I wasn't going to just deem myself an alcoholic and call it a day. I was going to try to come back and fly under the radar, and I did for about 8 months. I didn't get caught drinking, but I mean, I was. So
where are you now with what's going on inside you? I mean, let's look at your insides a little bit. Are you crying out to God in moments of desperation? Are you trying to get Him involved in what's going on in your world, or are you still kind of being Defiant Annie a little bit?
There was one night I went out in town and I got blackout drunk and I came back on base. And to this day, I still can't remember what happened. But one of the milestones looking back in the Marine Corps was this night in particular. I ended up just walking back on base. I disappeared for a while and I showed back up to the barracks with, I was bleeding out the back of my head. I had clearly fallen on my face. They took my blood alcohol content. It was a 0.296. Actually, I was later. I ended up having to go to the emergency room. I had to get staples in the back of my head and within a couple of days, both my eyes were swollen shut. I don't know what happened. I mean, I'm sure I had a concussion, and then just with the amount of alcohol that was in my system. But yeah, and I remember I woke up in the emergency room with an IV, and I had a receipt in my pocket from an ATM withdrawal, and I took out like $400. And I mean, I didn't know what I had spent the money on. I didn't know what had happened, and it was just a bad situation. And that was probably the first time that I ever sought to ask God to help me recognize what was going on. And I remember my mom was trying to call me on Skype, and I didn't want to answer because I didn't want her to see my face like that. Mm-hmm. Because I just really, I didn't have an explanation, and I was just always putting myself in those kinds of dangerous situations, you know, just a young female walking around in a predominantly male, you know, environment, and I was just always drunk. I was always, and not fall down type of, you know, embarrass myself drunk all the time. I don't want to make it sound like that, but I would just go on autopilot. I mm-hmm. really just would kind of, you know, I'd drink beer. I'd tell myself I'm just going to drink beer. But at some point in time, I'd be so full from having, you know, put away a 12 pack that then I'd be like, well, I'll have some shots. And then it's like, as soon as I started drinking liquor, I would just disappear.
Lights out, huh?
Yep.
Boy, George.
Just think how awful it would be. I know that I signed this piece of paper, Bill, that if I drink again, I'm in major trouble. I wake up in the hospital. I don't know really how I got there. I'm in the Marines. I signed this thing. You had to be dying inside, weren't you?
Yeah, I was scared every day. And then I just felt like nobody understood that it wasn't my choice. It's like I really believed that it wasn't my choice to drink or not. I remember a point where I was kind of leaning over my sink and staring at myself in the mirror and just like talking to my, you know, my inner spirit and be like, I was like, please stop, you know, like I knew that picking up a beer in front of anybody who would have like told on me would have ended my career. And I made that decision like over and over and over again. I hated myself for it. I really did, especially because, you know, how my brothers were deploying to and from Iraq and Afghanistan. And I just felt so stupid. I just was embarrassed. I had so much shame. It kept getting heavier and heavier. And, you know, I just was sick of myself, to say in the least.
Step one, I'm powerless. And there's a lot of shame and there's guilt. And we realize I can't stop this. This thing's bigger than I am.
Way bigger. Well, George, I think we're going to take a little break and we're going to hear more of how the Lord came in and gave Annie a whole new outlook. You're listening to Real Recovery. Thanks for being with us tonight. We're going to be back in just 1 minute. All right, George, this is not an easy story to be listening to. Annie, our guest, is a military career with the Marine Corps and signing letters saying that she will be sober for 365 days after a 28-day treatment in San Diego. Not a bad place to go for treatment. And all of a sudden, she just can't honor that.
Oh, it's
so
sad.
What kind of consequence might come out of that, breaking that contract or that agreement?
Yeah, well, there's something called an NJP. It stands for non-judicial punishment. It's basically the military's form of, you know, charging you with having broken one of the articles of the Uniformed Military Code of Justice. And I know that's a lot of military jargon, but I mean, I got NJP'd 5 times, which people typically can get out after just 2 with a pattern of misconduct, it's called. So, looking back, it feels good that they were trying to retain me, but, yep, I would gain rank and then I would get it stripped away from me after having broken those contracts to stay sober. And, I had people trying to reach out to me, but mostly a lot of like higher ups that didn't understand would just try to kind of yell at me and tell me that I was, you know, wasted potential and that I was, you know, throwing my career away. And I knew they were right, especially when I was sober. But what ended up happening, which was kind of the breaking point, was one night, I drank all night long, and then I got up in the morning to go to PT and run in formation and whatnot, and everybody pretty much knew and could smell it on me that I was just sweating straight booze, and I showed up to work and they gave me a field sobriety test and I completely failed it. And they actually went to go send me to the brig because they didn't know what else to do with me, which is military jail. And before they did that, they had to call the brig and tell them kind of what was going on with me, that I was on high levels of, you know, alcohol. And the brig said that they couldn't medically facilitate any, like, withdrawals or anything that I would potentially be going through. So they sent me down to another base, and I sat in the urgent care or whatever in the hospital for 3 or 4 days to detox. I remember that was no fun because I knew that as soon as I got out, I was going straight to the brig. So I went to the brig not knowing how long I was going to be in there. I was looking at being court-martialed, which is more severe than an NJP. It's like, I don't know if it's equivalent to like a felony, but I mean, it was no good. So I was facing that, and I sat in the brig for, I didn't know that I was only going to be in there for like 4 days, but I ended up getting out after that. And instead of getting that court martial, they let me sign a contract saying that I'd get out a year early and with a other than honorable discharge, and they let me just go home.
Mm. And then you go home and you realize you still need help. What happened then? Where'd you go?
I came home, like I said, with all that shame, big time. I didn't want to talk about it with anybody. I definitely didn't want to fulfill anybody's expectations of being sober. I was home for less than 2 weeks before I decided to up and move again. I kind of ran away again. I moved down to Denver, Colorado. I didn't know a single person out there. I thought that I could start fresh out there, but everywhere you go, there you are. So kind of was still a raging alcoholic down there. And it was down there that I joined a church and kind of was trying to do the things that I knew would be beneficial to me. So I was like reading scripture and going to church by day, but I was still heavily drinking and started taking up smoking weed again down there and smoking cigarettes and just fell right back into all those behaviors. So did that for a while.
You're right. You can change locations, but you take you with you. So what finally changed for you?
So I joined this church and they wanted that I hadn't gotten baptized publicly. So they asked me if I wanted to do that and proclaim myself as a member of their church. I got baptized and, they made a little video of it. And I remember saying that I wanted to do it because I wanted to draw a line in the sand. And I really thought that like when I came up out of the water from being baptized, that I wasn't going to be an alcoholic anymore. I thought that that's kind of how it worked, but it didn't. You guys know. And I just kept blacking out and doing, you know, making poor choices and kind of living in that sin. And I came home to visit for Christmas and kind of make up for some lost times. And I remember my dad had let me borrow his car while I was home. And when he handed me the keys, he looked at me and he said, "Whatever you do, don't drink and drive." So I went out to a bar and played pool all night long and drank and got in his car and went to go drive home and just got in a super bad car accident. I remember it was like 2 or 3 days after Christmas. It was 18 blowout. I was in Grantsburg, Wisconsin on Country Road, and I just kind of tried to overcorrect and fishtailed, and I ended up putting my car off of a like 30-foot embankment. I flipped it a bunch of times.
And his car, not your car. His car.
Right, yeah, yeah. His car.
Correction.
His car, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky to have walked away from that, and I truly believe that God or his angels or whatever it was supernaturally saved me that night.
Wow. So what'd you do when... Did you wake up in the hospital? Were you able to walk away? What happened?
I woke up hanging upside down from my seatbelt. I crawled out of my front seat, and I walked to the nearest neighbor's house, which in Wisconsin was like a quarter of a mile down the road. Mm-hmm. And I woke him up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I just told him that I had, gotten a little fender bender with the tree. Tree jumped right out in front of me. And asked him for a ride home, and they gave me a ride home, and I didn't address the situation until about 9 o'clock the next day. I woke up and called it in to the police department. And I remember, you know, having not a good conversation with my mom about it. And then we drove to the lot where they towed it, took two tow trucks to get it out, and paid them the money to get in to get my stuff. And it was completely totaled. It was almost unrecognizable from the front. And that was the end of my, that was the end of the road. My dad had been asking me to go to treatment. He asked me to consider going to Teen Challenge even after I had gotten out of the Marine Corps. So that's what I did at that point.
And how long of a program did you go into Teen Challenge?
I went into Teen Challenge for the long haul. It's 13 months.
Okay. And what happened there?
It was at Teen Challenge that I found complete and total freedom. I can honestly say that Teen Challenge saved my life. It's where I invited the Holy Spirit to come into my life, and I just was so empty and so broken. I knew that I needed God, and I needed Jesus. I needed a relationship with Jesus.
George, that's
worth the price of getting there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just the words that you're using right now are so powerful. That you needed the restraining power of the Holy Spirit and Jesus Christ to finally calm you down and give you new hope and new direction.
Yep, yeah.
Well, the key is willingness here. And she was willing. God will take the process from there. And so how was it right away? Were you just delivered and good, or was it a little bit of a struggle? Did you get a little better every day? Did you have some days where you went back a little bit?
Yeah, I would say that it was definitely a process. You know, because of my prior experience with going to church and stuff, none of it really freaked me out so much as it might somebody else not having that kind of background. But it was like, I remember every altar call, I was like wondering if I should go up there, like if I was like really, really saved, or if, you know, if I really had the Holy Spirit in me. So I questioned it every day. I guess I didn't find, like, deliverance, you know. I don't know. It was a process.
George, it's interesting because she has experiences where she joins this church in Colorado, and then she gets baptized, and she thinks she's got a new beginning. And, you know, people looking on that would say, boy, she really does. She's going to be really different. And the truth is, you weren't.
She does, but she's got to do the work.
Exactly. That's the point that I was trying to get to, and you had to jump on me.
Well, we don't have much time left, and I want to hear the rest of the story.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, yeah, it was layers. There was layers that needed to be brought down. And what's funny, though, is just talking about my story tonight, I never talked about the military in the 13 months of the program because I wasn't ready to actually tell anybody what happened. I was okay with letting people know that I was in the military and that I was in the Marines, but I kind of just let them think that it was all, you know, went smoothly. And, you know, I clearly had, and I got out with an alcohol problem, but I never let anybody into that really sensitive and intimate and, you know, secret place of what actually happened. And so it's just crazy how I know that God wants to heal me from that, because ever since I got out, it's been nothing but opportunities to talk about it and to bring it up. And it's actually something that I work on every day, is trying to get veterans into Teen Challenge, people who struggle with addiction, who, you know, have served our country. And it's just something I'm so passionate about. So this is really freeing for me, this opportunity to just say how it really happened.
I love that, Bill. God does not save us from our alcoholism and our sinful lifestyle. He doesn't have a job for us. Guess what yours is? Helping other people who've been through what you have.
Amen.
It's beautiful.
And, you know, you talk about your specific brokenness is making you incredibly eligible and attractive to other people in your situation who have had military experience, mm-hmm. who might be hiding some of the shame they feel or some of the pain they have. And so they can come and talk to a person like you, and boy, you just got that common bond right away. And I would think that would make a huge difference.
It does. She's talking their language. I've been there. God delivered me from this, the shame, the guilt. There's a reason for it. We're going to not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it because we'll see that our experience can benefit others. And yours certainly has. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. What a great story, Bill.
It's a great story. And it's the story of coming to a new life in Christ. And boy, George, here we are a week away from Christmas. And this is the reason we do the show is because Jesus came to save sinners. And we are ones needing saving, all of us. And if you're hearing the show tonight and you are not in a position where you've gotten right with God, please take time tonight to get right with God. Open up John 3:16 in the Bible. I think you can find that. He so loved the world that he gave his only son so that whoever will believe will not perish but have everlasting life. And that's our Christmas wish to you. Thanks for listening to Real Recovery. We're so glad you were with us tonight. Have a very Merry Christmas, and we will see you soon. Good night, everyone. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.